Well, folks, there you have it. The Mango Mussolini, the Orange Man, destined for jail, as we all knew, as we all predicted. I'm here with Jordan Yule. This is the Democracy Report, product of Krasenstein Media Incorporated. Jordan, how are you going to celebrate the saving of democracy?
I think at the core, we have to understand this is for sure a done deal, Jared. There is no chance whatsoever that Trump could once again wiggle his way out of this jam. So I think just spiking the football, celebrating as much as we can, is the one thing we should be doing in this moment.
Yeah, because if history tells us one thing, what can take out leaders of the world are process crimes. Just think about, you know, how they got Al Capone. It wasn't for murder, it was for tax evasion. And just in that same way, old Donnie is going down because he tried to cover up an affair he says didn't happen. Convenient, huh?
I mean, within that, like, I know we're doing a bit, but sure, this is one way to get him. Like, I don't know. I try to compartmentalize my cynicism. I think it's perfectly fine to be cynical about a potential outcome. But I do think people should recognize, and you're seeing that in some of the coverage, but it's from a different angle. It's this pearl clutching. Oh my God, this is such a serious moment for our nation. A former president has been charged with a crime. That he is the first one is remarkable because it shows how lax the system is for people in power. You know, many of them have done worse things than this, and they're walking around free today.
Yeah, one of the like pushback points from Trump supporters has been like, well, you're opening Pandora's box here. Do you want all U.S. presidents to be charged for crimes? And I feel like my response is like, well, if they committed them, sure.
That's the thing.
I don't know why that's like, I don't think that's like a ridiculously hot take exactly.
No, that premise is really bizarre to me because you talk to anybody. Any average political consumer, political follower, on either side of the aisle, just about everyone acknowledges there's some level of corruption in our system. And whether people follow through to that logical endpoint, which is acting on that through who you support and who you vote for, most people would want that system cleaned up. The right is having a knee-jerk reaction because it's their guy who got it first. I'd be happy if every corrupt politician was punished for their corruption. You're not going to get me on this, like, oh no, please, like the Charlie Kirk clip that went around today. All right, you want to indict Trump? We'll indict Bill Clinton.
This was a local DA that indicted Trump. We have thousands of Republican sheriffs, local DAs, and we have well over 25 Republican AGs. So this is not even about forget the federal government, because guess what? They just indicted Trump in a local area. So the equivalent is this. Okay, you indict Donald Trump in Manhattan. We indict Bill Clinton in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Figure it out.
Good. Okay. Yeah. Like, okay. What do you expect me to say here?
Yeah. Yeah. What am I going to do? Like run out in the street and like storm the Capitol building, my nearest Capitol building to, you know, save the reputation of William Clinton.
Yeah, please, not Bill Clinton. Anyone but him.
Not Bill Clinton. I'm a good Arkansas boy. I'm like contractually obligated.
I think you have to
defend Bill. Anyway, I'm here with Jordan Yule, co-host of The Insurgents, on this historic moment. I say that in jest, but you know, you kind of alluded to it earlier, which is like it kind of is historic, if only for the reason that like a president has not been held accountable for like pretty much anything ever. And it is a little weird to me to see this come down as, you know, it's not even like, oh, hush money is bad. It's just like you did the hush money in the wrong way. You know, I was kind of surprised just generally that they were able to convince a grand jury that this passed muster, especially with something so serious. Like I fully thought, you know, surely there would be a handful of jurors there that would be staring down the barrel of this and be like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I want to be part of this. I don't know if this is like where I want to go. But I guess, you know, we'll find out more in the days to come. But I guess it was compelling enough to get them to do that. I guess I was just kind of surprised by it. You know, I I'm not mad about it or anything. I certainly am not losing any sleep, but it is kind of, I mean, for better or for worse, it's historic, right?
It is. It is. I don't agree that this is, you know, something you can equate to, as some people on the right compared it to, the first shot in the Civil War. I don't think this means that we... I don't think this is the moment that we become a police state, as Glenn Beck insinuated last night.
Currency collapse, and we will live in a virtual police state. I know that might sound crazy to a lot of people. It's not far off. The Bill of Rights is gone. Nobody is paying attention.
We certainly have already lived in one. You have police who are militarized operating, you know, beyond reproach. They are killing people. Very few of them face any consequences. And they, which everyone saw in 2020, violently assaulted protesters who were calling for police reforms after the deliberate and evil killing of George Floyd. So this isn't a new moment in some, you know, police state that Glenn Beck thinks we're just now entering. What this, the significance on the history point is that this is just the first president who has been charged with a crime. Okay, maybe there should have been more. I would argue there should have been more. And I also think what we have done around the world and what presidents have done around the world, which wouldn't necessarily fall under the jurisdiction of a local or state prosecutor, is much worse than this. And the presidents who oversaw things like drone strikes, things like an invasion, an illegal invasion of Iraq, overseeing and covering up torture in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib, those things are much more heinous and a much larger stain on this country than Trump and his team committing business fraud, falsifying documents, covering up payments, things like that. Again, to go back to what I said earlier, most people, most well-meaning people who aren't in either party, acknowledge there is a level of corruption, not just in our political system, but also in our corporate world, and want that cleaned up because they know the effects of that. It's to their own detriment that that exists. But there's this cognitive dissonance between acknowledging it exists and wanting that cleaned up, especially if it's your own party doing it. That's what Republicans were trying to leverage, but I think people need to step back. Instead of complaining that this is a partisan political process, acknowledge, hey, this is just something that is reflective of this mass system-wide issue that you purportedly care about. Here's your opportunity to actually show you care.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because breaking this down on partisan lines is certainly what partisans would like us to do. It is a story not of a rare moment of accountability for, you know, the leading executive, but a story about a Democrat deep state coming for Trump. I think that just kind of gets me like to what you mentioned earlier, which is reactions on the right. After events like this, being somebody who researches like the far right, extremism, my phone starts rolling off the hook of being like, what are you seeing? What is, you know, they're calling for civil war. What's up with that? And it's like, to me, I'm getting remarkably similar vibes that I got after the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago. A lot of this rhetoric about, you know, this is the first shot in a civil war. This is, you know, we have to fight back. It's gloves off. They said all that stuff after the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago. They said all that stuff when news of this indictment stuff started going around, and they said it again. And I guess that could change in the weeks and months to come, depending on how serious it gets. But it just doesn't seem like they really have it in them. I mean, I guess it's possible, or even somewhat likely, we see a couple folks like spin off and maybe commit violence, or, you know, some small scale protests and that sort of thing. But something that I've been trying to convey to reporters and, you know, various people I talk to through work is that I feel like there's this temptation after all big news items like this, especially ones that are negative towards Trump, of there's still kind of that reflex post January 6th where people in these big organizations, corporate news organizations, that missed the ball on the Capitol riot. are scared of missing the next thing, right? But I just don't know. I think there's like a combo of reasons. One is like paranoia that everything is a Fed trap going around on the right. Another thing is just, you know, Trump just doesn't have the swagger in movement conservatism that he once did. You know, I guess I'm curious if you have any thoughts on like the reaction from the right. I guess like everything I said is to say that this, the sort of punchback or like initial outburst seems almost kind of predictable from these partisan folks. But I just am not convinced this is going to turn into real action. I don't know how many people are going to like lay it down to protect Trump from getting charged for a hush money payment.
Right. I think you can differentiate this from January 6th, where there was a collective feeling on the right that they were disenfranchised and they were cheated in the election. I mean, they were fed those lies by powerful right-wing people, people in the right-wing media. That's what led in part to January 6th. There's only one guy who's really a victim here. They're just sympathetic. You can see the difference just looking at the crowds in Fort Lauderdale last night, or Palm Beach, wherever the hell, Mar-a-Lago, I think Palm Beach.
Palm Beach, yeah.
There were, what, maybe a dozen people, like, waving flags on the side of the road? Okay. It's just, they don't have any skin in the game. They love the guy, sure. They're going to support him. They're going to post on Truth Social more than ever this weekend. That's it. They might donate. But that's really probably all we're going to see. But on the rhetoric point, look at this in a historical context. The Civil War language isn't new. I made a supercut in 2019 of all of these right-wing hosts saying that we are on the precipice of a civil war then. And I just looked back before this episode just to see what was happening in the news in October 2019. Like, nothing. It was just Trump was in power. You know, people weekly were being fired from his administration. Everything was in chaos. The Democrats had taken back the House, but that's it. Like, he wasn't facing any trouble or anything like that. I think he might have been impeached by that point, but that's it. Like, they were saying it then, and they were saying it for a variety of different reasons. Ben Shapiro, I think, said it, if you were going to try to indoctrinate his kids in schools. Like, it's this type of hyperbolic language just shows how much our media, and especially online media, has spiraled out of control, and the incentives for doing that. That the rhetoric has to continually be ratcheted up to keep people in this ongoing state of fear and panic, so they continue to look to you for reassurance, for comfort, for positive reinforcement. And this is the point that the right has reached, where everything is a civil war. And viewers, I'm sure, and some of them are primed for it, but I don't think this is the linchpin for action.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Glenn Beck earlier. Through like the entire Obama years, Glenn Beck, I mean, like so many of these guys, Obama would be like, oh, you know, I don't know, maybe more people should have access to healthcare, which I have my own qualms with the approach to that, of course, but that was supposed to be the wave of communism coming into America and, you know, the time where patriots had to stand up and defend everything. It's just, you know, I kind of see this as like a fixture of political discourse. And I think, you know, your observation is correct, which is that especially as these, you know, our media environments move online and are subject to, you know, the different incentives built in to various platforms, that incendiary rhetoric, you know, generates attention. People have strong reactions to strong statements. And, you know, these platforms want engagement, they want input so they can collect our data and sell it to God knows who. And all the incentives are wrong. Like the way money is made on the internet incentivizes the wrong things. And yeah, I feel like that is probably just like a deeper systemic problem that could probably do like 50 episodes on. But fear and outrage is never something we would do on Posting Through It. It's just good vibes only.
Yeah. Appreciate that you're taking that stance. But it's tougher, right? It's tougher to build a sustainable, independent operation when you're being serious, you're being nuanced, you're rooted in reality. It's part of it. I mean, part of it's just consumer behavior. People like to be shocked and titillated. People like the, you know, risque and the violent. We see it throughout our pop culture. Being sensible doesn't necessarily sell. It might sell some books, but that's about it. The right has done a really good job recognizing the market incentives for being outlandish. And that's why you have people comparing a white collar fraud crime to a nation going to war over slavery. Like, it's just, that's the point we're at.
Two things, you know, they're just different sides of the coin at the end of the day, Jordan. I guess the last thing before we talk about what's happened in Nashville and also some of the reactions to that, which have really just left a taste of metal in my mouth, it is sort of the refrain that I've heard from, you know, a lot of leaders of like the Democratic Party since this indictment, which is this idea, and we sort of talked about this earlier, but like that this is proof that like nobody is above the law, which I still, to me, just seems like so laughable. Of course he is above the law. That, like, of course presidents are above the law. Of course people are above the law. Rich people are above the law because like they don't play by the same rules. They're not held to the same standards, and they have so much money and power they can do, like, they can manipulate stuff, right? Something about that, like, refrain, I think it comes from a good place where it's like, oh, this is a demonstration that it doesn't always have to be that way. But something about it just kind of sat a little weird with me.
Well, it's idealistic. And I think that you alluded to that, and it coming from a good place. What I mentioned at the beginning about the cynicism over the outcomes, I think it's perfectly fine to acknowledge, yes, this is the system we want. This is our ideal system where everybody has the law applied to them equally. You can hold that while also acknowledging we're fighting for this because it's a system where that isn't the case. It's a two-tier justice system. The rich, the powerful, the politically connected, they rarely face the same consequences, especially for white-collar crimes, that the poor, the working class, and especially the Black community in this country, they don't experience the justice system the same way. You know, look at our prison population. Look at the demographics of our prison population. And you can see clearly how this is an idealistic statement. So I don't knock people for trying to fight for a better outcome here. But again, I don't know what will become of it. It's a lot tougher to sell a jury on this kind of stuff. It's easier to get an indictment than a conviction.
Right.
So the fight obviously now becomes convict Trump, but
which could take years. You know, I don't foresee this getting in the way of a presidential run at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess before we move on to talking about Nashville, I think, you know, I owe a lot of resistance libs an apology. You know, the predictions that Trump was going to jail may have not panned out during the Boehner investigation. It might have not, you know, panned out after various panels, you know, about Russian interference. It might not have panned out after January 6th, but, you know, they were onto something. And, you know, Ed and Brian Krasenstein, please accept this formal apology. And I wish you the best of luck with the crypto coins or whatever the hell it is you're selling now.
Nobody in that world was convinced that this was going to be what they got him on. You know, it was everything else. So it's, everyone was wrong. Every single person was wrong.
Which, again, going back to it, it's idealistic. It's hard to fault them for having some hope, but yeah. I don't know.
I mean, the guy was brazenly corrupt. Like, it just, I thought the best chance of them getting him was enriching himself while president off of
the whole hotel thing.
Yeah, that I thought was the one thing they were going to try to get him on, but nobody touched it.
It's just like, oh, this lobbying group just came in and spent $250,000 at this guy's hotel, and what do you know? They've got a meeting on the books now.
Yeah, like that I thought was much meatier than this. I know?
yeah, we're just two guys with microphones, right? That's why we're not running the place. I just wanted to spend like a couple of minutes here at the end talking about what happened in Nashville. On Monday morning, a person wearing camo pants, a black vest. I don't know if it was a bulletproof vest. It's some sort of tactical style vest. And carrying three guns, AR rifle, AR pistol, and handgun. Walked into a Christian elementary school and killed six people. Three of those people were children. That by itself is like horrifying. It is unfortunately far too common in the United States that stories like this happen. And the very next week, there's another story just like it. Certainly lots of issues there. But what has happened this week, I guess, before the Trump indictment, I've seen a few people try to like mesh the two, and we can talk about that. But there's been this fixation on the shooter in this case, which it's always a bad idea to fixate on these people. But the right has taken a special interest in this person because, according to some reporting and a little bit of online footprint, this shooter was recently identifying as a transgender man. The name that they, you know, are reported to have gone by was painted into the side of one of the firearms. But there's been this like big push on the right to try to highlight this tragedy as proof that, you know, Christians everywhere are under attack and that transgender people are, you know, not only a supposed risk to themselves, but an existential risk to communities that ideologically don't gel with them, like Christian communities, like conservative communities. There has also been calls. Police reported that they found a manifesto, some different writings left by this individual before they committed this attack. There's been a big call from different politicians in Tennessee, national figures like Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, to try to get those documents released out to the public, which is particularly disgusting to me. Doesn't matter who does what, I will always be one of those guys that's like, you don't need to share the manifesto. This is a document written by someone who just went out and killed a bunch of people. Like, you probably don't need to actually circulate that around. But yeah, it's just the whole thing has been really dark. And even through the Trump indictment and like Douglas Mackey got indicted in New York, that's really interesting to me. I just still feel like really sick about what I saw on display this week.
Yeah, we have to separate the shooting itself from the right wing, the ongoing right wing crusade against trans people. And you have to juxtapose their crusade with and the reaction to the shooting with how they have responded to every other mass shooting over the past, you know, decade and a half.
Especially white supremacist ones where they are very much like, don't read the manifesto, don't give this this guy any credit. They kind of went out the window in this case.
Don't read the manifesto, just tune in to hear it in Tucker's opening monologue. Like, they pay no mind to identity, race, ideology, anything. When, you know, the 98 or 99% of other shooters and mass shootings reflect their values, their views, and look like them. Here, it's, oh, this is great. We can leverage this for our ongoing war against trans people, people who just want to exist. It was nothing short of disgusting how they responded. Because again, so often you hear after shootings, don't politicize this. Don't be guided by emotion in this moment. This is not the time to politicize. This is not the time to call for gun control. We just need to mourn and send our thoughts and prayers. Here, it's the blood has not even dried, and transgender people are the greatest evil. This is a quote from Ari Drennan, who joined us on Insurgents earlier this week. She pointed that out, that Matt Walsh was immediately saying that trans people are the greatest evil in our society, like right after it happened. It was disgusting and opportunistic. If you want to talk about real problems with mass shootings, you talk about the guns. Because if you remove the gun from that equation, that person going into that church and that school, they're just trespassing. With the gun, it's a mass shooting. Like, that's your distinguishing factor. It has nothing to do with their identity, and especially doesn't reflect an entire community of people they already have hate and bigotry toward. Because this person clearly is not well. If they are taking out whatever is going on inside of them through mass murder, That you wouldn't do that for, they would not do that for any other identity, but they're doing it here because they already hate trans people. They already have a culture war where they're waging against trans people because they want to continue to divide and belittle people who are already marginalized in our society. And this is what it looks like. It was grotesque.
Yeah. And a lot of it too is just like deeply cynical, which was made apparent to me after the Trump indictment came down and you started seeing different conservative influencers like that DC Drano guy or the like cat turd twos of the world. Insane that I can say that into a microphone and anybody listening might know what I'm talking about. But these like high profile conservative, just I don't even know what to call them, just posters. They just make money by posting. And they just post stuff that their audience will like. Like, as soon as this indictment came down, it was this pivot of like, you know, oh, a transgender person goes in and shoots up a school. And what do you know? Here comes this indictment to distract everybody. And it's like, what the fuck is it? Like, do people's brains like really work like that? It's almost hard to believe. It's very like House of Cards, spy movie, like it's like trying to understand the world as a movie.
Yeah, it's I think we have to remain optimistic on this issue, though. This is another thing we talked with Ari about. You could see the evolution on marriage equality in the late 2000s, early 2010s. You know, it was very, very slow, and then suddenly all of these states rushed to recognize the right to marriage equality. And now we're at the point 10 years later where Congress doesn't even really want to touch it. Some do, but it's codified now. So that is a huge swing in our national history in a very, very short time. On the right, that recognition and acceptance, I think, came from more and more people on the right knowing people who are gay. We're going to see the same sort of thing with trans people. Once more, people feel comfortable through our support, through support of their communities, coming out, being true to themselves. More people on the right are going to know trans people and realize, hey, they're just like me. They have the same interests as me. They work next to me. They're my neighbor. Why? It becomes a lot harder once you personalize the issue for people to continue on hating them. And it's definitely tough, and we have to stick up for the trans community. But I do think there is some cause for optimism here.
I think that's a good note to wrap up on. Jordan, thanks for joining me to hash some of this out. I, you know, was messaging you earlier and saying, you know, I think a lot of podcasts are going to sit down and do like the really big brain, hard thinking stuff, which is great. It's great when people do that. Mm-hmm. I'd do something a little different this week. I appreciate you giving some time and chatting with me. Tell people about The Insurgents, a great podcast that you co-host that I've been on a couple times. Where can people find that?
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Jared. So The Insurgents, a podcast I host with Rob Rousseau. It's mostly politics and news, but we do get into some other aspects of pop culture, sports, things like that. Look at things from a left-leaning perspective. We try to, we try not to delve too far into the just purely cynical territory because it's okay to care about things. We've been doing it for a few years now. It's at theinsurgents.substack.com.
Caring about things or podcasting?
Both. It's at theinsurgents.substack.com. We'd greatly appreciate you tuning in, and if you can, subscribing.
Yeah, I think this is your first time on the show since it rebranded as Posting Through It.
I think so.
There is still the same final question, though, which is, what's your favorite thing on the internet right now, Jordan?
My favorite thing on the internet right now is this guy. I see, I don't have TikTok, but he cross-posts his TikToks on Instagram as Reels. He does this character where he's this trench coat wearing fedora having like anime nerd who is marrying his Mikasa body pillow, and Mikasa is a character from Attack on Titan, which is a show that I just discovered a week ago or 2 weeks ago and have been binging because it's fucking amazing. And it's, he just has this character down so, like, so well. And he has these videos where he's doing different scenarios, like getting rejected from a restaurant because he can't bring his pillow in, or arguing with his mom about the pillow having a seat at the dinner table. It's just, it's really funny, and it gets me every time.
All right, Jordan Yule, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Turn up the numbers on.